KALW.
They didn't even know there were Indians left alive, so it kind of took them by surprise that we popped up.
Half a century ago, dozens of Native American activists occupied Alcatraz Island.
Welcome to Yulamu. We welcome you ashore. The Ohlone community welcomes you in a good way. We are grateful that you had a safe journey.
Oh! We'll hear from people fighting to preserve their culture. Then, the story of a popular Japanese magician in the United States during the 1800s inspired one actor to tell his story on stage.
Slightly snarky remark that as a kid, you know, I would look at the magicians of the time and it's like, and none of them looked like me. And any person of color gets that.
And we'll take a look at the natural world of Shakespeare in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park.
It's an old tea rose, so it spreads, it puts out a very nice flower.
I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba, and this is Cross Currents. 50 years ago today, indigenous people who called themselves the Indians of all tribes began a 19-month occupation of Alcatraz Island. The goal was to protest broken treaties and to reclaim Native American heritage. Native American tribes celebrated the lead-up to the anniversary with a canoe trip to the island last month. They gathered near Alcatraz to honor both the history of the earth and the elders who fought to defend their place in it. KALW's Holly Jim McDeed reports.
The sun is just beginning to rise, and the moon is still visible and full. More than 200 people, representing dozens of Native tribes, gather at Aquatic Park on the shores of the San Francisco Bay. Ed Archie Noisecat grew up by British Columbia's mountains. He helped organize this canoe journey. He says it's a celebration of nature, an indigenous history rooted in water.
That is where we are all coming from. You know, we're the waters pulled us together, the water sustained us, and the water gives us life.
Canyon Sarah's Roots is a member of the Indian Canyon Mootsin Band of Coast Unknown Ohlone people. She also goes by Coyote Woman. She offers encouragements before the tribes push off towards Alcatraz. She says this canoe journey is also about remembering a more contemporary history of indigenous resistance. 50 years ago, activists sailed to Alcatraz to reclaim Indian land and bring attention to the government's mistreatment of them.
I am blessed and lucky to witness cultural resilience of indigenous peoples from all around, that we are still here.
Moi, moi!
The Native War Jack was one of the original occupiers in 1969.
I'm just thankful that I'm still alive, and the plants, the animals, the water, the pollution that's going on, you know, we just need to continue our prayers because we wouldn't be here without those prayers.
She says a treaty from 1868 gave Native people the right to federal land once it's abandoned. And Alcatraz Island had been abandoned in 1963 when the prison shut down over costs.
Well, shame on them. I mean, you know, it was like another broken treaty right in front of us in this day and age. Of course, you know, government broke every single treaty we had.
The Coast Guard tried to stop them, and the government cut off electrical power when they arrived and blocked access to water. In this archival footage, occupier Richard Oakes sarcastically offers to buy Alcatraz for $24, glass beads, and red cloth. The occupier said that was the same price that Indians supposedly received for the island of Manhattan.
We will further guide the inhabitants in a proper way of living. We will offer them our religion, our education, our life ways, in order to help them achieve our level of civilization and thus raise them and all their white brothers up from their savage and unhappy state.
Wojcik says the occupation attracted national attention for indigenous people who had been largely invisible.
They didn't even know there were Indians left alive, so it kind of took them by surprise that we popped up.
The occupation ended in 1971 when the government forced the last activists off the island. But Wojcik says living on Alcatraz forever was never the point. They wanted reparations for broken treaties and to establish ecology centers and space for Native culture.
And of course, that's the first thing we wanted to establish was our identity as Native people and bring back our culture and our spiritual ways.
During the occupation, President Richard Nixon ended the government policy of forced assimilation. He returned the sacred Blue Lake in New Mexico to Native people and provided funding for reservation-based healthcare programs.
Taking the island ignited everything. It's like a rock that hits the water and it just keeps on going.
Wardak says the occupation's message about resilience and community still flows through Indigenous rights movements today, from Standing Rock to marches for climate to canoe journeys in the bay. After circling the island, the canoes make their way back to San Francisco. Per Indigenous protocol, tribe members ask for permission to return as they get closer to the shore.
We heard there used to be canoe people down here. We come to share our good medicine with our songs and what the canoes bring when they're on the water.
Native elders and community leaders are there, waiting to welcome them back to the land.
Welcome to Yulamu. We welcome you ashore. The Ohlone community welcomes you in a good way. We are grateful that you had a safe journey, and we are happy to share space and share a feast. So please come ashore safely, and welcome to Yulamu. Oh!
In San Francisco, I'm Holly J. McDeed for Cross Currents.
All this week, there will be talks and events to mark the 50th anniversary of the occupation on Alcatraz. An exhibit titled Red Power on Alcatraz, Perspectives 50 Years Later, opens this Saturday. The exhibit and many more related cultural events will continue for another 19 months. That's the same length as the original occupation. Find out more at kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. Around the mid to late 19th century, Japanese magic shows were very popular in the United States. A magician named Namigoro Sumidagawa brought the art form to America and stunned crowds with a box trick. But Western magicians appropriated his act and performed in yellowface. Actor and magician David Hirata tells the story on stage in A Box Without a Bottom, Soko Nashi Bako. This solo show is part history, part David's own story, and a touch of magic. David Hirata spoke with KALW's Janae Darden.
What sparked your passion for magic?
You know, it's kind of an old story of the kid who gets a magic set on his seventh birthday. And I think part of it was I was really lucky this magic set I was given was this kind of arts and crafts project thing. It had cardboard cutouts that you would kind of glue and tape together to form these little trick boxes and tubes and things. So it really gave me an opportunity to really get involved with that secret mechanical part. And then a few years later when I started learning sleight of hand, the idea of performing these secret moves when it's pure sleight of hand, and also trying to make it look beautiful or to be funny, it shouldn't look like juggling. That's always fascinated me.
Because the tricks in the show, they are beautiful.
Oh, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, no, they're definitely beautiful. I mean, and, you know, they're amazing, too. You're in awe when you see them, but there's a beauty to it.
Yeah. I thought, for instance, the piece with the linking rings, you know, that it occurred to me that there's a beauty to those objects, the way light reflects off them when they move in space, or the sound of them as they tap together. And those could be used to tell this story within the show.
This story that you are presenting in this show is really amazing. The magician, his name is Namigoro Sumedagawa. Mm-hmm. How did you learn about his history? And just for people, you know, give us a little background for people who haven't seen the show.
Sure. Namigoro Sumedagawa was a Japanese magician of the 19th century. And in 1866, the Japanese government, because Japan had been closed off from the rest of the country during the Tokugawa period for 240 years, and then with the arrival of Commodore Perry in 1853 and the eventual opening up of the country, in 1866, the shogun started issuing actual passports for travel to the West, and the first one was issued to this magician, Namigoro Sumedagawa, who traveled with a Japanese vaudeville troupe, the Imperial Japanese Troupe, as it was called. It was put together by a Westerner, by an American named Richard Risley Carlyle, show business entrepreneur who thought this stuff would be a hit in America. Mm-hmm. And he collected the performers and got all the paperwork, came to America, huge, huge hit. I had been doing research. I had originally thought to try and tell kind of the story of America by telling the stories of American magicians from the various places in American history. And I came across this article about these Japanese vaudeville troupes. There were about 8 or 10, I think, at the peak, and the impact they had on American popular culture. And the title of the article was Paper Butterflies, which referenced one of Sumedagawa's most famous tricks. He would take a few pieces of tissue paper and cut them into the shape of butterflies and gently fan them, and they would fly about the stage like butterflies.
Yes.
It's a beautiful trick. It's extremely difficult to do. I have a shortened version that's not, I'm sure, is not nearly as good as what he must have done. So Namigoro Sumedagawa was known in the American press as the butterfly conjurer, and this butterfly trick itself was quite famous, and I just kind of went, wow, this was very much a part of the introduction of Japan to the West.
The show is weaved with past and present.
Yes.
Because we're talking about this, you know, the history of this magician. And then you, part of your story.
Exactly.
Yeah, coming up as a Japanese-American man.
Yes.
Navigating race and an industry that we're, you know, Asians are underrepresented.
Yes, and I think this idea of weaving my story with these two other magicians, and Sumedagawa is the main one. He casts the greatest shadow in the show. I mean, part of it is just, I think, that idea. I kind of make a slightly snarky remark that as a kid, you know, I would look at the magicians of the time, and it's like, and none of them looked like me. And any person of color gets that. It's like these famous people in this field I love, they don't look like me. Mm-hmm. And so this idea that here was this man, symbolically at least, the first Japanese to come over, not in actuality, but in a symbolic sense, with the first passport, that's a kind of wow moment for me. And the way he interacted with Western magic, I just kind of thought, holy crap, you know, what Japanese magicians appeared to be willing to do, to sort of combine sleight of hand with mechanical principles or chemical principles or optical principles, was remarkable.
How much of an influence has Japanese magic had on Western magic?
Wow, that's difficult to say. I mean, this prop, the Sokonashi Bako, of course, became something of a standard. The butterflies made their way into Western repertoire. These have had a definite influence.
I was reading a blog post you wrote, and that you said you communed with his spirit to learn his magic and his secrets.
I wanted to try to get at his art. What was it like for him to perform magic, duplicate his art, follow in his footsteps in that way, in a physical way that was available to me? If I know what the props are, if I know what the sequence of moves is, then I can get a little bit inside his head. And the first thing I got out of it was the amazing discipline of this man. I tried to reapproach what could be done with the Soko Nashi Bako. So all the magic you see me do in the show was invented by me sort of with this, and I think that's part of, again, trying to get at what would Namigoro have done with this? Mm-hmm. Do I think he might have done with this? It became very complex. A lot of magic is really beautiful if the secret part, the secret maneuvers that you, the audience, don't get to see is often for us very beautiful.
He was erased in the past.
Right. It's really exciting to find this man who must have been a great magician, who was so interesting when I read his words. And gosh, he looked like me, and he helped kind of blaze the trail for Japanese Americans.
That was actor and magician David Hirata speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. Catch his show, A Box Without a Bottom, Soko Nashi Bako, at the Marsh in Berkeley, now until December 1st. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba.
What's in a name? That which we call a rose. By any other name would smell as sweet.
In San Francisco, there's one special place where you'll find flowers from the writings of William Shakespeare growing. Just west of the bustle of the California Academy of Sciences in Golden Gate Park, there's a garden dedicated to English literature's crowned prince. You can easily miss it, but once you pass through the entrance gate and walk down a worn brick path, you're transported into an English garden filled with manicured flower beds, trimmed lawns, and people who are escaping the noise of the city. In this story from our archives, Jeremy Dalmas visited the garden.
Thanks, Tommy. Let me see if I can find it up here. Because... I know a bank whereon the wild thyme blows, where oxlips and nodding violet grows, quite over, canopied with luscious woodbine, with sweet musk roses and with eglantine, there sleeps Titania, some time of the night, lulled in these flowers with dances and delight.
Joe Shemaleski is scanning a row of bronze plaques. Each one is stamped with quotes from William Shakespeare's works.
And that comes from A Midsummer Night's Dream.
We're in the garden of Shakespeare's flowers. It's an enclosed nook of Golden Gate Park that's filled only with plants mentioned in the writings of the Bard. Shemaleski is one of the park's gardeners, and he loves the flowers here.
Along the fence there is the eglantine roses.
What's an eglantine rose?
Oh, I just found out what it is. It's a great rose. It's an old tea rose, so it spreads, it puts out a very nice flower, but then you just get this brilliant rose hip behind it. And so, yeah, it's very nice. Yes.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And so so that's what that is.
This garden, though it's special, is not really unique.
This is one of several Shakespeare gardens throughout the country, and there are several others around the world. And they're all basically outlined the same way, 17th century classical garden.
Cleveland, Manhattan, Vienna, Johannesburg, all of them have Shakespeare gardens. Most of them were built in the early part of the 1900s. This one opened in the summer of 1929, and there's a reason why there are Shakespeare gardens and not Mark Twain or Hemingway gardens. Eric Anderson, the superintendent of Golden Gate Park, says that the Bard's work translates well to landscaping.
He mentions plants really vividly and really in depth in a lot of his works.
Do you have a favorite flower here? Or favorite tree?
To be honest, it's my favorite tree is the cedar here.
The tree stretches tall above the flowers, presiding over the entire garden.
It's a great specimen, and I suspect that it was one of the original plantings, and it's a really beautifully shaped specimen covered in Spanish moss.
Lauren Sabadin comes to the garden often. Today, she's lying on a blanket with an old book.
I was actually just reading my poetry book and trying to draw some inspiration and awesome. Do some writing.
The book that she's reading from is actually the same age as the garden, filled with poems from the early 1900s. She reads me part of her favorite one. It's called The Philosopher.
And what are you that, missing you, I should be kept awake as many nights as there are days with weeping for your sake? And what are you that, missing you as many days as crawl, I should be listening to the wind and looking at the wall? I know a man that's braver man, and 20 men as kind. And what are you that you should be the one man in my mind?
That's so nice.
Yes, she has a crush on a philosopher. Edna St. Vincent Millay.
Beyond inspiration, Sabadin says the garden offers her a refuge.
It's my escape from the bustle of the city streets. Yeah, come down to just enjoy the beauty and peace and quiet. I love to read and write and nap down here. Catch up on my sleep a little bit.
You know, Shemileski,
the gardener, is getting ready to leave. He's about to lock up a set of steel shutters that enclose the bust of Shakespeare himself. It's a unique replica of a famous one from the writer's hometown in England. He's holding a quill and looking straight ahead, like he's posing for me. And there's an inscription under the statue. A gift to our city from the town of Stratford-upon-Avon and its former mayor, Archibald Flower. Oh, wow.
You know,
that's lucky that we got it.
Yeah, right.
Park Superintendent Anderson says they normally keep the statue locked away. Perhaps, back in 1929, you could have valuable busts sitting out in the open. But not so these days. In fact, if you look where there are supposed to be 6 plaques with Shakespeare quotes, today there are only 4, and a couple of blank spaces. Those 2 plaques were wrenched off the wall in 2008, most likely stolen to be sold for scrap metal. No matter how tranquil it may seem here, we are still in the middle of 21st century San Francisco. For Cross Currents, I'm Jeremy Dalmas.
Jeremy reported that story in December 2014. You can find more stories about Golden Gate Park at kalw.org. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast so you can hear the sounds and stories of the Bay Area wherever you go, whenever you like. Tune in tomorrow at 5. A team of San Francisco public defenders is attempting to change the system with high-speed legal defense.
We watch people's lives crumble because the criminal justice system has kept them incarcerated, and that doesn't make them safer.
Rapid response lawyers. That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. Now let's listen to a local band. This is Margalie from Oakland. They're playing at the Ivy Room in Albany tomorrow night.
Because I am a mad scientist. The trick is to forget the control. Cause like a feline, I'd rather see Frankenstein than let my curiosity go. Make a machine, make life.
The Cross Currents team includes Imran Ali Malik, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Truk Nguyen, and Joshua Sorodiak. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tarek Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adel. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as reinterpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.